Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope. I'm your host, Rory Hearn, and I'm joined today by Dr. Lucy Michael, who is a sociologist in practice and a consultant on equality and integration issues. Her work addresses racist discrimination and violence, the experience of victims, and the roles of statutory institutions and civil society in combating hate crime and exclusion. She is the author, with Brian Fanning, of Immigrants as Outsiders in the Two Irelands and of Unsettling Whiteness. She's also a commission member on the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission, and she's a leading member of the Fingal Communities Against Racism. Lucy, I'm delighted to have you with us on Reboot Republic today.
Thank you for having me. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Great. And I'm really looking forward to our conversation because it's something, racism and discrimination kind of flows through a lot of issues that we talk about in Reboot Republic. And I think there's no doubt that, it's been very worrying over the last few months and indeed, years to see the rise in racism in Ireland. And I think it's interesting because we see ourselves as a welcoming, kind of caring country, and we have our own history of famine, of emigration, the support for the UN. But yet we also have, with recent social crisis, this blaming, for example, of migrants for the housing and homelessness crisis. We have that rise in opposition to direct provision centres. And of course, we have our history of deep racism and discrimination towards travellers. And I was thinking in preparing for today, I was thinking back to the citizenship referendum in 2004. And I remember actually over 20 years ago now, it is almost to the month, I was involved with a group in Tramore in County Waterford in opposing the deportations of a Nigerian woman and her children, Ebi Ojo. And we organized marches in Tramore at the time. And I remember being struck at the time, and in many ways it hasn't changed since then, that there's quite a strong vocal support for, refugees, for asylum seekers, very clear, people very, very committed and supportive. And then there's this kind of, incipient racism that's around, that's sometimes hidden, sometimes silent, sometimes not silent, that people, it's a very, I think I kind of struggle to get my head around it, what's there. And there's no doubt, like we saw the huge support, for example, for the welcoming of Syrian refugees. Again, more deportation campaigns more recently, supporting school children in Tullamore. But there is still this structural discrimination in our housing system. The migrants who are affected by overcrowding, homelessness, travellers. And then, of course, your own work, which has been hugely positive, as an example of work at a community level being done, intervening around the elections, trying to stop deportations, the idea of creating a welcome, inclusive Ireland. And I think that the overwhelming majority of people in Ireland actually would believe and want an Ireland that's welcoming and inclusive. So why then have we this rise in racism, and in particular that far right parties or more or less so parties, but networks of individuals? What's going on?
Well, I think I'm probably speaking straight to a matter of your heart when I say that I think a lot of this, both on the positive and negative side, is about our idea of home. We are still in the middle of a housing crisis. How many years later? So many of our ideas of who belongs in Ireland are about who we see as part of our home, our homeland, who is legitimately building their homes here, both in terms of, emotional, social, psychological home, as much as a physical, material home. And those ideas of home have very often touched on, I think, the most vulnerable parts of the Irish psyche, if you can talk of such a thing, with our idea of what it means to have control of your own home, your own space, and where your family are. We're very touched by emigration. Many of us have lived and made homes in other places across the globe, and I think that's been really positive for how we see the world and those who come to make their homes in Ireland. But it also touches on this real vulnerability that we see in the kinds of mobilizations the far right are attempting around the motto of house the Irish first, you know, which implies that somehow the Irish are not getting housing ahead of migrants, which, you know, when you look at the figures, it just is a nonsense. But to be able to touch into that idea of home is what has made the Fingal mobilization we undertook so strong. Because we were tapping into that idea of who lives in your community, who is part of your community, who is growing up in your community and is part of your home. And really at that local level, you've seen it yourself in terms of anti-deportation campaigns, to be able to talk about our neighbours, our families, our friends, really allows us to see the humanity in this issue. But when you turn it into an abstract notion of invasion at large numbers, you know, Irish people being dehomed, I think that's where the far right have really pulled on an international playbook and tailored it to this Irish psychological element that's around housing and home. But certainly when it comes to Fingal, I mean, people who live in Fingal, whether you've grown up there like I did, you know, from a very much a village mindset living in Fingal, or whether you're from somewhere else in the world or somewhere else in Ireland and moved to Fingal, it's an area that really is very strong in terms of neighbourhood identity. Appealing to that idea of home was a very successful strategy that we were able to use around the by-election and the general election. Now have been able to turn into connection and solidarity with asylum seekers and refugees in a way that perhaps we didn't anticipate at the start of the campaign last summer.
And maybe you could explain a bit more of that, because it was striking that, you know, again, the issues that predominated, and obviously we're talking now in a pre-COVID period and we're talking about the pre-COVID period in terms of the general election, that, and, you know, we need to talk about COVID as well in terms of, you know, how has that changed the landscape of racism. But if you look at it, you know, housing, health were the dominant issues, not immigration. And maybe you could talk a little bit about that, like, how did you, what role did you play at that local level in turning that around? You know, what sort of discussions did you have, or what sort of, you know, you described that idea of, you know, appealing to the concept of home. How did you, you know, in terms of talking to people on the ground at the doors, what did you do, and what were the kind of the cases, arguments, discussions that you had?
Well, I think it's important to acknowledge that Fingal Communities Against Racism came out of networks that were built across marriage equality and Repeal the Eighth movements around those referendums. And that meant that the people who were activists in our networks were already people who were used to having difficult discussions about highly emotional issues.
Yeah.
And in a way, the candidate that ran in the by-election in Fingal made it very easy for us, because we were able to contrast those who'd made their home in Fingal and who were a living, breathing part of our community, who were our friends and neighbours, our colleagues, our schoolmates, with a far-right candidate who was parachuting in hate and using, weaponising our diversity and our neighborhoods as a kind of model of something you should be afraid of.
Yeah.
And again, because of the pride people have in our neighborhoods in Fingal, appealing to that, to say it is not for an outsider to say what we are and are not happy with. And it is not for an outsider to come in and pick off some of our friends and family and make them a target of hate. You know, we decide the future of our communities, and we have already decided. But the fact that Fingal is a good place to live, is a place where people are, you know, mix every day, we already made that decision. We made it through our everyday interactions. So for someone to come in and say that we should hate half of our community, you know, is really not the kind of outsider you want in your community. So those conversations are not easy, and we drew a lot on international research, both in terms of political campaigns, and there was quite a lot to choose from in Trump's America for good practice examples, but also the work that so many of the activists in Fingal and across the country had done around those recent referendums. So we produced initially a small leaflet that we could distribute around Fingal, around the doorsteps and train stations and bus stops. And, you know, a huge range of the political candidates in the by-election helped us to distribute that. You know, this was really all hands on deck. And so part of the success really was about trying to pull all of the political positions in with us. Apart from
what were the kind of key messages you said on that leaflet? Like, what were your messages?
Our messages were very much about being a place that had a very long history of diversity, and a place that was very proud of its diversity, that was successful, but that also understood things like housing or health issues, and that these were not issues that were government. There were not issues that were immigrant led; they were government led. And so we very much framed it as, we are people who are not going to be easily persuaded to accept a scapegoat, particularly when that scapegoat is our own communities. And so that first leaflet really was about appealing to people's sense that they knew better than the messages that they were going to hear in that campaign. Our fear was that as that anti-immigrant candidate hit the doorsteps and got media coverage, and thankfully she got relatively little at the local level, relatively. But our fear was that other political parties and independent candidates would start mimicking her messages. Particularly if she was seen to be garnering votes in any part of the community. And so we used the Irish Network Against Racism anti-racism protocol quite effectively, because we got every candidate bar that anti-immigrant candidate to sign up to the protocol. And we reminded them what that was, and we made sure that everybody knew that they had signed up to it. We did a huge amount of publicity around that on national media and local media. And that really was about holding them in a space where they had committed to an anti-racism founded election, and that they felt bound to our communities to stay in that mode until the end of the election. And we used that communication very strongly with them to say, we are trying to help you to distinguish yourself from that anti-immigrant candidate. And we will be monitoring what you say during the course of this election, right across those towns and villages. And we had people, you know, contacting us day in, day out, telling us what people were saying on their doorsteps, what political candidates and their campaigners were saying on the doorstep. And if somebody had an anti-immigrant message, we went straight back to the candidate and said, your campaigners in X part of the community are using anti-immigrant sentiment and we don't like it.
And there was candidates doing that.
There's always people who are afraid to tackle that on the doorstep, but I'm pleased to say in Fingal there wasn't a lot of it. And anything that there was at the start was very easily dealt with by the candidates. And the candidates were very strong in doing that. Independent candidates were probably more drawn to it than establishment candidates in Fingal. But we know that campaigners for establishment candidates in other constituencies were doing it, because we were hearing from them too, saying, is there a group like yours in our constituency? And that's really disappointing. We saw, you know, around those elections last year, we saw Fine Gael having a problem with Verona Murphy, for example. You know, and we saw Varadkar not wanting to tackle the issue of racism in Fine Gael. You know, and that's to have a party in government not wanting to tackle those messages, not wanting to address racism in its own party. You know, so many people said to us on the doorstep, we're really disappointed by that. And so we really wanted to encourage the Fine Gael candidate in our community, in our constituency, to tackle that directly. So, you know, candidates were successful to varying degrees in the extent to which they took part in the FCAR campaign. Some parties, you know, were very vigilant in getting our leaflets and bringing them out, in talking about them on the doorsteps. Others were happy to say that they'd signed the protocol and show up for the photo shoot. But look, the important thing was that, you know, people did show their true colours on the immigration question in that election. And we were able to hold a space where we distinguished all of the candidates from the far right. That's really important to be able to stop them polluting the space and to hold political discourse to a standard is just crucial.
Mm. I think it was a very important intervention. When you look at like it, in terms of, you know, the achievement of a civil society group, you know, within an election, a political context, I think it's a very, very good example of being able to challenge, you know, the far right and racism in that effective way. And do you think you did have an impact?
I think we had an impact, you know, it for a very new group that really was experiencing its growing pains at the same time as trying to take on such a project. It was exhausting. It was exhilarating. We learned a lot of lessons from it, which we're now sharing with groups right across the country. I think what we really learned is your group doesn't have to be perfectly organized to make an impact. You don't have to be a particular type of people or have a particular set of experience. You can learn from others who have done that. And very ordinary people can do quite extraordinary things in terms of resisting hate. And that was a message we drew very strongly from international movements. I think when you're confronted with hate in your own community, on your own doorstep, by a candidate who's determined to take an election down that road, you really have to make a decision about whether you're going to allow that to happen. And waiting to see if the mainstream parties follow is too late. If you don't tackle it right up front and hold the mainstream parties to account, you'll probably experience what we've seen in the UK. Where we saw Farage given more and more and more media coverage over the years, where we've seen the English Defence League on primetime programmes, where we saw Nick Griffin of the BNP calling for forced removal of immigrants from the UK on primetime TV. And discussed at length, where we saw Katie Hopkins having so much coverage in the UK, as well as here, I might say, Pat Kenny, of course, was one of the ones who had her back several times. Although, he was one of the ones who gave FCAR a huge amount of coverage when we set up last year. So, the exposure of those anti-immigrant messages has a huge impact on its growth. And the more we can do to try and tackle that as it's emerging and not wait for it to become established is really important.
And so taking that from then to now, here we are, you know, at the end of 2020, you know, with COVID, the pandemic, where do you see the far right now and racism kind of through that COVID period, and how is it, you know, shifted and changed or has it? And what do you think we can do now or, you know, to continue to combat that anti-immigrant message and promote and create an Ireland of welcomes?
I think there's three things we learned about the far right over the last year. One was that they were really, and this is a product of its history in Ireland, very small, very disorganised. But number two, it has some very violent, very dangerous individuals within it. And three, they are using an international playbook. They are using the same messages and the same strategies that are used by far right and neo-Nazi groups across the globe. And because they are tried and tested in the same ways we use tried and tested strategies from other countries to counter the hate, you know, they have those strategies in that playbook. And we highlighted that last year quite strongly in the RTE primetime programme about the housing and about the issues in Balbriggan being part of that international playbook. And since COVID, so much of the work that we had intended to undertake this year was really displaced. You know, we wanted to be out in schools, that went to hell. We wanted to be out, you know, in community meetings. But in actual fact, you know, the fact that communities were organizing more virtually, more was online, more was on WhatsApp, we were able to connect that message with a lot more people, but so were the far right. And what they did essentially was move away from the messages around immigration, which hadn't got them a huge amount of votes in those elections, and started to move more and more towards anti-mask and conspiracy theories, more around concerns about housing, and realizing that really they had to kind of build an audience first and then use that anti-immigrant message. So we've seen far-right groups deleting anti-immigrant propaganda from their sites. We've seen them refusing to acknowledge anti-immigrant stances or even taking contradictory stances with the media on some of those questions while they build that that base. And that's really, I suppose, the worrying thing going into next year is how they will use that base that they've built during the pandemic. And where the anti-immigrant messages will really start emerging again there. It's very clear in the UK that those anti-immigrant messages are starting to come in very strongly again in the anti-mask groups. There have been new connections made between the far right and other groups across that period. And it's really quite concerning. I mean, certainly I've been watching what's happened in England as well. I've lived in two areas of England where far-right politics were always on the edge in Stoke-on-Trent and in Hull. And having lived in both those places, I'm very familiar with the kind of geopolitics of it. And both of those places were very strongly populated by anti-mask protests and conspiracy theory. And they're both places with long histories of anti-immigrant parties trying to garner votes there. And they're places that are, you know, vastly, you know, pro-Brexit and really strongly reflected the anti-immigrant messages of Brexit. My concern is that we will see some of that here, that the anti-mask groups will turn to an anti-immigrant message again with a bigger audience. And we really have to come up with some, I think, quite drastically different strategies to tackle that.
And have you thought of any of those as of now? Is there anything in terms of, aside from trying to, you know, build the consensus around masks, and I assume the vaccine will be similar, that, you know, how strongly do you think they are, you know, behind the, you know, we've seen the protests on the streets and, you know, they're very clearly there, that they are growing within that.
The anti-vax groups and the anti-mask groups are, you know, very much a crossover there. You know, same with the kinds of groups that have been proponents of bleach treatments for autism. Same as the kind of groups that have been, you know, determined to bring back abortion restrictions in Ireland. There's a lot of crossover between groups across those topics. And it fits with the wider international agenda on those too. I suppose the worrying thing is we've seen new audiences like in the wellness community. We saw a lot of messages being shared in those social media forums. And those are people who are very concerned with health in general. But to have those far-right conspiracy theories shared in those circles is worrying because that's a whole new audience and not an audience that's usually anti-immigrant. That's an audience that tends to be much more liberal on those kinds of social issues. So we've seen those new audiences. And I guess really what we have done in FCAR and in collaboration with other groups is to have conversations about how do we enter those social media spaces safely? How do we open up conversations in groups that are starting to shut down? How do you use social media messages really effectively to bring people into conversation? And one of the things that that we've been doing is trying to talk to people about what skill building do we need to have those difficult conversations. So one of the things we did last year at the general election was we published a leaflet, and in fact, it's still on our website in case anybody's interested in it, and called Difficult Conversations. And it was about how do you have those conversations with your dad or your sister or your neighbor or your work colleague when they come out with something that you know is based in myth, in untruth. And we did that specifically with immigration in mind. But the same principles are applicable to so many of the messages we've seen this year around COVID and now around, you know, the anti-vax element of that.
And in terms of the housing, is that, you know, are they organising or trying to organise around that issue?
Housing, oh, certainly. Tonight in Blanchardstown, there is a House the Irish First vigil, you know, which is very worrying. And I'm sure that it won't get vast numbers because most of these vigils and protests get relatively small numbers on the street. But the message gets into the main discourse. And that idea of how's the Irish first is a very powerful one in its implication and in what it calls for people to do, which is to be incredibly nationalist in their perspective. It's racializing. The idea of the Irish in How's the Irish First is not including our new citizens by any means. It's absolutely a nativist Irish idea. And it's not a new idea. The How's the Irish First idea we saw particularly strongly conveyed in the protests at Mulhuddart last year, which, of course, just falls inside our Fingal boundaries. And we talked to Fingal County Council about the new housing in Mulhuddart and who it was being allocated to. And I don't know if you remember, but there was a standing protest in a tent at that housing estate in Mulhuddart last year. And the Irish Times went out and covered it, and RTE Drive Time covered it. Yeah. And they did what so much of Irish media is doing now, which is to describe the far right on their own terms. So not to take a view on what those politics are and to describe them accurately, but to describe them in how they describe themselves as housing activists. Or, you know, John Waters was described by the Irish Times just the other day as a civil rights activist.
Yeah.
You know, having spent COVID telling us not to wear masks, you know, and having spent the previous number of months telling us how immigration is killing our country. You know, and he describes himself as a civil rights activist, and the Irish Times quote that as if it's fact. But that has been true of how the Irish media have treated the far right for the last 2 to 3 years, at least, if not longer. And it's something that's quite concerning because the audience relies on media to give them the facts, to give them an accurate description of what's happening. And if you don't describe the far right in accurate terms, the audience will take them on the far right's terms. And that's a problem because then they're taken to be good faith housing activists as opposed to nativist campaigners. That's a problem.
And in terms of those messages around, do you think that they are getting resonance, that idea of how is the Irish first and clearly that anti-immigrant sentiment within it?
I would say they certainly appeals to people who are feeling the pressure of the housing crisis. They are designed to hit those people who are feeling most vulnerable in our current social, economic, political situation. And I would be very surprised if it wasn't getting an audience. The question really will be whether that audience has a balance from the other side of anti-nativist messaging, I suppose is the way to put it. Whether they really taking to heart that allegation that non-Irish or new Irish are getting housing ahead of Irish citizens. And we saw it in Mulhuddart that people did want to hear that message. And there is a distrust that the far right is building in statistics. So presenting statistics from Fingal County Council was still not necessarily convincing to many people because that was the very group that the far right had told them to mistrust.
Yeah.
So it's difficult to counter those kinds of messages. And you know, I think with the House the Irish First idea, like you see it in graffiti in a neighbourhood in a housing estate, as we did in Blanchardstown 3 nights ago, whether you see it on a Facebook organised vigil, as we see in Blanchardstown tonight. Those messages were also in Balbriggan around the election last year. And they're very much about building that anti-immigrant sentiment around a particular issue and then hoping to generalise it. We know that housing will be a massive issue in the next election. And so a group that are pushing a nativist message around housing will push that nativist messaging right into the election. And I would worry about it polluting that whole political discourse in an election again.
Mm. Because you do see it from time to time, like in my own, you know, interactions on social media, you know, I'll constantly get, you know, an almost a lot of housing posts that I'll put up. Someone will reply and say, you know, at the core of your problem that you, you know, refuse to take on is that migrants are the cause of this housing crisis, you know. And it's interesting, of course, with the, you know, the statistics are there that, you know, it's the housing crisis, as we know, of course, is caused by, you know, a failure of government policy over decades and decades to, you know, to build affordable and public housing and to, you know, to allow the vultures in and all those different reasons. And that the idea, of course, as well, is that, you know, migrants themselves are being affected at the harshest end by the housing crisis in terms of overcrowding. And I suppose it does highlight as well, and it's, you know, that age old, you know, in terms of from a left perspective idea and concept and organizing, that in vacuums where people are left and there is no, you know, in a sense, organizing going on in a progressive sense, that vacuum leaves a space where anti-immigrant sentiment grows. So rather than, you know, housing campaigns, which we know there are, for example, the new CATU union, the Community Action Trade Union, that is organizing, you know, renters. But the importance of actions like that, that bring together migrants and, you know, Irish in all our new forms and diverse forms, is actually the way that can counter that, is really, really vital and important.
Yeah, and I think one of the interesting things that's come up around the Brexit debate is actually to highlight the pressure that the Dublin business puts on housing. So housing pressures are not necessarily caused by the residents themselves, by owners or tenants, but by where we need to live because the economy is organized in that way.
Yeah.
The economy is extremely Dublin focused, which stacks the housing market in that direction. So of course you can get affordable housing in some other parts of the country, but can you live or work there? And that is a problem. I mean, you know, when we talk about migrants in Ireland, you know, the far right would have you believe that they're all asylum seekers and, you know, or that they're all false asylum seekers.
Bogus, yeah.
But of course, you know, 15% of Ireland is born outside of Ireland. And many of those are people who are professionals, who are migrant workers with particular skills. And the labour market has been stacked in a particular way to welcome some migrants and exclude others. I think that some of the blame for this falls with the way that the Irish government in the early 2000s talked about migration to Ireland. Because from the late 90s, as we saw immigration rising, and I was an 18-year-old then, you know, starting to wonder what this Ireland was that I was becoming an adult in. And that was where I got interested in what was Ireland going to look like in 10 years, 20 years. But what the Irish government was doing in the early 2000s was really kind of groundbreaking for a small nation, anti-racism work. Really good practice and seemed to be a leader in what it was doing in terms of a country newly experiencing immigration. But all of that was put in place because the government wanted migrant labour to be safe, to be welcome, to be included, because they needed international labour. And when the recession came, you know, post the 2004 referendum, which very much targeted asylum seekers, so they were always excluded from anti-racism measures as far as governments were concerned. But come the recession, you know, government is talking about encouraging migrant workers to go home. But of course, by then, many of them had families in Ireland, you know, they had settled, had invested here, had become part of our communities. And to go home to where? To economies that were not doing well, to not have jobs and so on. But that was the government line, was that migrant workers should go home. In other words, that they'd never really belonged here. They were only welcome for their labour. And that message stuck around for a long time. So when we looked at the Irish Network Against Racism iReport data, still years later, people were talking about how the immigrants should have gone home when we had recession, how people's children had to go to Australia, but the immigrants stayed, and how dare they? And, you know, we launched iReport with Einar in 2013, and those messages were still coming in racist attacks from people to say, you know, our Irish had to go to Australia and Canada and the immigrants never left. They should have left. You know, that's 6 years after recession, 5-6 years after recession, those messages were really strong. And I put that absolutely at the feet of government, that during the recession, they blamed immigrants for jobs disappearing.
And there's no doubt as well, like, and I mentioned it at the outset, that when you go back to 2003 and 2004, that referendum led by Michael McDowell, the Minister for Justice at the time, who, you know, tries to forget his own past and deny it. And we'll, you know, welcome if he's now a committed anti-racist, that's great, and wants to overturn the referendum. But... you know, the argument at that time embedded that, you know, real sort of sense, as you said, you know, not that anti-immigrant sense during the recession, but that the anti-asylum seeker, you know, and that idea that they're scroungers and they're come over. Of course, at the heart of that time, he made the case that, you know, our maternity services were being flooded because people were coming over to have children so that they get Irish citizenship. And, you know, that embedded that idea of, you know, asylum seekers as scroungers. And it's something that is there still. You know, how do we counter, you know, that idea of the fear of the other, you know, and the fear of this, you know, scrounger, bogus migrant taking it from us? How do you counter that?
Well, one of the reasons, of course, that it's so strong in Ireland is because many of us don't know asylum seekers. We don't know refugees.
Don't know travellers either.
We don't know travellers either. And of course, that is about the physical separation of communities. You know, as I said right at the outset today, you know, we think about who belongs to our home, who's part of our home. And from the 60s, when the Irish government had an assimilationist policy for travellers to force them to settle, you know, we've always been persuaded to see travellers as not being part of our homes, not to want them in our neighbourhoods, not to want them as neighbours, unless they're in houses. And so we've lost that idea of what it means to have an Indigenous minority who are nomadic and who have their own culture, because they don't fit in that idea of home that has been created by social policy over the last 50, 60 years. The same is true with the direct provision system. I mean, it was set up entirely to counter the idea that there might be an influx of asylum seekers from the UK when Westminster introduced overnight its dispersal policy in 2000. And the next thing is Mosny Holiday Camp gets turned into an asylum centre. You know, and the direct provision system has grown and grown and grown on an extra legal basis. There is no law that governs direct provision, which is why it's still a for-profit system. And why you could never really take action against it in law, because it simply was never established in legislation. And direct provision divides up those who are seen to not yet have a claim to home here from those of us who do. And even people who say, I think there's an asylum seeker child in my child's class, but they don't know the parent, they don't know the child, there's very little connection. And the system is designed to keep them separate. So talking to asylum seekers living in direct provision, you know, the way that life is organized there ensures that they never go out or leave for too long, because there's surveillance of who they were with and what they're doing and, you know, whether they're there for meals and whether they stay overnight and so on. But also there's a stigma and a shame of being an asylum seeker and living in direct provision that discourages social interaction. Both from Irish and others living in our communities who don't understand what it means to live in direct provision and don't know how to interact positively with people living in direct provision, and those who do live in direct provision not wanting to admit that they do. And so there's huge psychological and social barriers, as well as the physical isolation that direct provision has established. I mean, they've been called, quite rightly, you know, centres for easy deportation, you know, because it's, as last Thursday, you know, we saw GNIB can knock on the door at 5 a.m. Much easier in a direct provision centre and deport you than they can do if you live somewhere else. But direct provision is essentially a holding system. It stops people integrating in communities. And I mean, I use integration as a kind of multi-directional idea. It's not for migrants to assimilate into our way of life, but for us all to adapt to one another. But we don't do that because our interactions with asylum seekers are so rare, you know, and often we don't even know that they're happening. So that level of integration simply isn't possible. And so what we've seen with travellers becoming more and more marginalised, we see with asylum seekers too. I mean, it has a huge impact on people's lives after direct provision. We know that in terms of employment, in terms of health, in terms of their social connections. So that isolation, that separation really worries me.
And just in terms of what do you think are the key things that we need to do to change this?
How long have we got? I have an enormous list, Rory.
I know you do. But we're just before Christmas, so let's ask Santa.
Oh, I think Santa would probably tell me I've been a good girl this year and I can have one or two of them. What do we do to change racism? Well, I think there is certainly issues that we can tackle in terms of legislation. We have some equality legislation, but it's almost impossible to enforce. It's very difficult for people to vindicate their rights. The Workplace Relations Commission, for example, is just not effective enough in terms of people being able to vindicate their own rights when they know they're victims of discrimination. There's the wider issues of social policy, like traveller accommodation, that just seem intractable and really need some political will behind them and public pressure to move them on. There are issues in terms of not being bystanders, knowing that if we see discrimination, and I don't mean just like a violent attack in the street, but if you know that a landlord will not rent to Africans in your neighbourhood, you know, what do you do about that? Do we have a responsibility to stand up and do something? Well, there's no government leadership on any of that at the moment, which is very disappointing. We certainly need action in terms of education. Education system in Ireland still defines racism as a form of bullying. That's the only way it's defined in the Irish education system. So never mind your diverse curriculum, which we certainly need. We also need very explicit anti-racism work in the education system. We need immigration firewalls and policing that better respect the rights of minorities and migrants in Ireland, to protect them from hate crimes, but also just in general, and give them access to justice. And we need laws against racial profiling. We don't have those. We saw even during COVID that Gardaí were going around house to house to talk to people in the community, do some shopping and so on. Minority and migrant communities were completely excluded from that. You know, Gardaí did not come and say, hello, do you need anything? What can we do for you? And levels of trust around policing just went through the floor, particularly in places like Balbriggan, where racial profiling of young people during COVID was just exhausting day in, day out. And there's still so many criminal cases resulting from that. And we need massive change in terms of the direct provision system, but also the international protection system in general. So, Rory, that is my Christmas list.
Very good. Do you
plan to bring any of it?
I think we mightn't be relying on Santa for this one. I think we all need to step up on this. We all need to become Santa Claus for anti-racism.
You know what? I think we could do with a few elves, all right.
Yeah.
I suppose, you know, if there's one message I would you really try and draw on, and I try and draw on it myself too, day in, day out, is that it doesn't take, you don't have to be an expert in this area to do something. You know, you can do something in your own community. You can do something in your own workplace. You know, I turned around in one of the situations I work in recently and said, where's our equality and diversity policy? You know, very simple, like things like that, to just say, you know, have we embedded this in our practice? You know, if you work in a school, is there an effective anti-racism policy in your school? Have your teachers had any training? If you're a parent, you know, what does it look like in the sports clubs or youth groups that your child is part of? You know, if you are working in the media, you know, what kind of approach is there, or what kind of policies are there in your organization? If you're a consumer, you know, what kind of messages are you responding to? We know that a number of businesses over the last year were using quite explicit anti-racism jokes on social media to attract their audience. So, you know, refusing to be a consumer in places that use racism as PR is a very simple thing that you can do. So I think no matter who you are, no matter what you do in Ireland, there is an opportunity to step up on racism.
I completely agree. And just to finish up, Lucy, I wanted to ask you about two things. One was, you know, what motivates you, you know, in terms of the amount of time you dedicate to this? And it's not an easy issue. Do you know what I mean? And oftentimes it's extremely challenging. I was quite struck by, you know, just seeing the work you were doing around, you know, anti-deportation work. And it must be, you know, exhausting and upsetting. You know, what motivates you, and how do you keep going yourself around this?
My first interest in this was when I was 20 and I was a law student in Dublin. And we were challenged to write an essay on, you know, whether you would have a traveller site at the end of your street. And believe me, in a law class in UCD Dublin in 1999, you want to see the answers to that question. But also, you know, we were looking at an Ireland that was getting more diverse. And I was influenced by the messages from the UK that this was about integration. Of course, multiculturalism was in trend in the UK at the time. And I went to the UK to do a master's to try and understand, was there a way of doing diversity better, of learning those lessons from countries like the UK or elsewhere? And really, I suppose I was surprised by my own reactions in the UK, how little I understood about racism. And so, you know, I spent many years in the UK. I was there to do my postgraduate degrees. And then I worked in England, in Hull. So I was in Stoke-on-Trent, Manchester and Hull. And then I moved, 6 years ago, I moved to Belfast. And all of that time I was doing research work in Ireland with NGOs and communities here, because Ireland is home for me. Yeah. And I suppose having that view of across the UK and Ireland, one place where I belonged and one place where I did not, it really kind of opened my eyes to what it is to be a migrant, even in a country like England, where, you know, you're white and, you know, for me, middle class and educated and so on. But to live a migrant life, I think, opens your eyes to how resilient people have to be a migrant, the kinds of meaning that home develops, and what it means to have to decide if your future is in a place or not. I left the UK, you know, as they were starting to talk about the Brexit vote, you know, and it didn't happen till 2 years after that. But the place I was in was changing around me, even 2 years before the Brexit vote, around who belonged and who didn't. And so I think, you know, I've always had that very strong sense that we should do whatever we can to try and make the places that we live in feel inclusive, and that people have equal opportunities to education, to employment, to housing, you know, a fair go at justice, you know. And my work has always been in universities, and you know yourself, like, university work doesn't happen Monday to Friday. I ran a women's centre in Hull, you know, huge issues of disadvantage and poverty, but also, you know, with refugee women arriving at the centre to learn English as well. So these issues around housing and disadvantage and migration, you know, they intersect with one another. When I left the university last year to set myself up as a researcher full time, you know, I suppose with the launch of Fingal Communities Against Racism, we entered into more and more spaces that we never imagined we'd be in. And I didn't think I'd be spending my weekends fighting deportations, I have to admit. You know, deportation is something I only really learned about in the last year. It isn't something that is talked about a lot in anti-racism circles. And it probably should be. But I think a lot of us feel very nervous talking about a topic like deportation, because there is such a sort of law and order discourse around it. And certainly in the last week talking about it, people have said, oh, well, you only get deported if you deserve it. So we definitely need a better conversation about deportation. Mm. That's for sure. Mm. You know, and who deserves to or not to, or doesn't deserve to be deported. But, you know, I'm extraordinarily lucky to work in the area that I do and to be able to do the campaigning, you know, in with friends, with colleagues that we do. And meet the most incredible people. So I consider myself very lucky to do that. I'm very passionate about the subject, and I'm lucky to spend my time doing that.
And just to finish up, we mentioned earlier the because it's interesting that, you know, as, you know, an academic who has, you know, got your PhD and been a lecturer, and, you know, the traditional path would be to continue on and become professor and, you know, continue up that path and that ladder. But you decided something very different. Why?
Yes, I had for a long time been involved in what I suppose you would call applied research. So working very closely with community groups to try and resist institutional racism. And I was doing more and more of that at the same time as academia really was becoming about chasing very large grant applications. So I was being named on grant applications and working on grant applications that were in areas that were really not what I was interested in. Universities can be quite isolating because very often there is one expert on housing or racism in a university department. So trying to collaborate with other universities across what's an increasingly competitive space in the UK higher education sphere was difficult. And then, you know, some universities are very well geared to dealing with issues like equality. Others are not. Some are very well geared to supporting researchers who want to do something a little bit different, particularly in the area of social justice, and some are not. And I had a lot of disappointments around that. I was increasingly disappointed with the lack of interest among senior colleagues in tackling gender inequality in universities, in tackling race inequality. A lot of cynical strategic moves for PR that didn't match up with my colleagues or my students' experiences. So I did a lot of work in the trade union in UCU while I was at Ulster, and a lot of work with students to address race inequality in the university, as well as with other universities across the UK. And I think that frustration over a number of years really came to a head. And I decided that a lot of my time was being spent on things I was not interested in and passionate about and where my talents were not best used. And I made the move to get out. It's something that you hear a lot of academics talking about, particularly women academics who are faced with very severe gender discrimination. Now, I have to say, you know, the gender discrimination didn't particularly impact me, but I saw it all around me and I was very frustrated with the lack of response to it. I did a lot of work defending ethnic minority and migrant lecturers from disciplinary processes they should never have been in, you know, as a result of racism they experienced in the institution. That was very frustrating. And I was really disgusted by the precarity that was entering the sphere. Again, I was really lucky to miss that. I got my first academic job in Hull and went to work in Hong Kong and managed to turn my job into a permanent post very quickly, unlike many people in academia. And again, in Ulster, I was lucky to land a permanent position. But so many people around me working on in the area that I work in still are scrabbling together bits of teaching, trying to do research while not being in permanent positions, trying to keep their research agenda fresh while paying the rent, and doing that for 6, 7, 8 years post-PhD. And I think that higher education is really, it has become such a toxic space. It's certainly not, for me, wasn't satisfying enough to give up the time and the energy that it requires to stay there. So now I'm doing what I think a lot of other people have tried to do and hopefully will manage, which is to balance the academic interest, the applied research and the activism. So one thing that I've done, for example, is that with the Sociological Association of Ireland, I have a new study group with Dr. Eben Joseph on race and ethnicity. And we've brought together all of the scholars in sociology and social sciences across the island into that group. So we have an issue of a magazine coming out after Christmas on Black Lives Matter, our reflections on that. So that's one way of kind of trying to tie together the academic and the professional and the activist and try and do more of that in the coming years. Irish academia, I think, is in for some severe changes in the next decade if it follows the UK model. So I wouldn't be surprised to see a lot more decisions like that being made. I hope it doesn't go that way, but I fear that it will.
Well, Lucy, Michael, thank you so much for joining me today on Reboot Republic. It's been an inspirational talk and discussion and chat, and You know, I wish you the best in your work in the future. And, you know, I know that the work that you're doing is having a massive impact, and will continue to have so. And best luck with Fingal Communities Against Racism and the Irish Human Rights Commission and the other work. And do you want to, in terms of just let people know the name of your consultancy, your research consultancy, if they're interested in following up on that work?
Certainly, yeah. You can see my work at lucymichael.ie. And I work for a whole range of NGOs and international organisations, as well as doing training for employers and so on. So have a look at that, and by all means, get in touch. I'm almost always on Twitter and always welcome the chat with anybody.
Great. Lucy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And as always, listeners, we put out the call to you. Become a patron. Go to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Support us to keep going, putting out these podcasts. We know you like them. We know you're listening. Help us to keep going on this journey, the independent media, putting out the solutions, putting out the ideas, talking to the best guests, the frontline activists, workers, change makers. And yeah, we're not sure when this is going out. So happy Christmas and happy new year. And we'll chat to you all soon.